Settling into the Ashram by Paul Brunton. The ensuing weeks absorbed me into a strange, unwanted life. My days were spent in the hall of the Maharishi, where I slowly pick up the unrelated fragments of his wisdom and the faint clues to the answer I seek. My nights continue as heretofore in torturing sleeplessness, with my body stretched out on a blanket laid on the hard earthen floor of a hastily built hut. This humble abode stands about 300 feet away from the hermitage. Its thick walls are composed of thinly plastered earth, but the roof is solidly tiled to withstand the monsoon rains. The ground around it is virgin bush, somewhat thickly overgrown, being in fact the fringe of the jungle which stretches away to the west. The rugged landscape reveals nature in all her own wild, uncultivated grandeur. Cactus hedges are scattered numerously and irregularly around, the spines of these prickly plants looking like coarse needles. Beyond them, the jungle drops a curtain of scrub bush and stunted trees upon the land. To the north rises the gaunt figure of the mountain, a mass of metallic tinted rocks and brown soil. To the south lies a long pool whose placid water has attracted me to the spot, and whose banks are bordered with clumps of trees holding families of grey and brown monkeys. Each day is a duplicate of the one before. I rise early in the morning and watch the jungle dawn turn from grey to green and then to gold. Next comes a plunge into the water and a swift swim up and down the pool, making as much noise as I possibly can so as to scare away lurking snakes, then dressing, shaving, and the only luxury I can secure in this place, 3 cups of deliciously refreshing tea. "Master, the pot of tea water is ready," says Raju, my hired boy. From an initial total ignorance of the English language, he has acquired that much and more under my occasional tuition. As a servant, he is a gem, for he will scour up and down the little township with optimistic determination in quest of the strange articles and foods for which his Western employer speculatively sends him, or he will hover outside the Maharishi's hall in discreet silence during meditation hours, should he happen to come along for orders at such times. But as a cook, he is unable to comprehend Western taste, which seems a queer, distorted thing to him. After a few painful experiments, I myself take charge of the more serious culinary arrangements, reducing my labor by reducing my solid meals to a single one each day. Tea, taken thrice daily, becomes both my solitary earthly joy and the mainstay of my energy. Raju stands in the sunshine and watches with wonderment my addiction to the glorious brown brew. His body shines in the hard yellow light like polished ebony, for he is a true son of the black Dravidians, the primal inhabitants of India. After breakfast comes my quiet, lazy stroll to the hermitage, a halt for a couple of minutes beside the sweet rose bushes in the compound garden, which is fenced in by bamboo posts, or a rest under the drooping fronds of palm trees whose heads are heavy with coconuts. It is a beautiful experience to wander around the hermitage garden before the sun has waxed in power and to see and smell the variegated flowers. And then I enter the hall, bow before the Maharishi and quietly sit down, folded legs. I may read or write for a while or engage in conversation with one or two of the other men or tackle the Maharishi on some point or plunge into meditation for an hour along the lines which the sage has indicated. Although evening usually constitutes the time specially assigned to the meditation in the hall, but whatever I am doing, I never fail to become gradually aware of the mysterious atmosphere of the place, of the benign radiations which steadily percolate into my brain. I enjoy an ineffable tranquility merely by sitting for a while in the neighborhood of the Maharishi. By careful observation and frequent analysis, I arrive in time at the complete certitude that reciprocal inter-influence arises whenever our presences neighbor each other. The thing is most subtle, but it is quite unmistakable. At 11, I return to the hut for the midday meal and a rest, and then go back to the hall to repeat my program of the morning. I vary my meditations and conversations sometimes by roaming the countryside or descending on the little township to make further explorations of the colossal temple. From time to time, the Maharishi unexpectedly visits me at the hut after finishing his own lunch. I seize the opportunity to plague him with further questions, which he patiently answers in terse epigrammatic phrases, clipped so short as rarely to constitute complete sentences. But once, when I propound some fresh problem, he makes no answer. Instead, he gazes out towards the jungle-covered hills which stretch to the horizon and remains motionless. Many minutes pass, but still his eyes are fixed, his presence remote. I am quite unable to discern whether his attention is being given to some invisible psychic being in the distance or whether it is being turned on some inward preoccupation. At first, I wonder whether he has heard me, but in the tense silence which ensues and which I feel unable or unwilling to break, a force greater than my rationalistic mind commences to awe me until it ends by overwhelming me. The realization forces itself through my wonderment that all my questions are moves in an endless game, the play of thoughts which possess no limit to the extent that somewhere within me there is a well of certitude which can provide me all the waters of truth I require, and that it will be better to cease my questioning and attempt to realize the tremendous potencies of my own spiritual nature. So I remain silent and wait. For almost half an hour, the Maharishi's eyes continue to stare straight in front of him in a fixed, unmoving gaze. He appears to have forgotten me, but I am perfectly aware that the sublime realization which has suddenly fallen upon me is nothing else than a spreading ripple of telepathic radiation from this mysterious and imperturbable man. On another visit, he finds me in pessimistic mood. He tells me of the glorious goal which waits for the man who takes to the way he has shown. But Maharishi, this path is full of difficulties and I am so conscious of my own weakness, I plead. That is the surest way to handicap oneself, he answers unmoved. Disburdening of one's mind with the fear of failure and the thought of one's failings. Yet, if it is true, I persist. It is not true. The greatest error of a man is to think that he is weak by nature, evil by nature. Every man is divine and strong in his real nature. What are weak and evil are his habits, his desires and thoughts, but not himself. His words come as an invigorating tonic. They refresh and inspire me. From another man's lips, from some lesser and feebler soul, I would refuse to accept them at such worth and would persist in refuting them. But an inward monitor assures me that the sage speaks out of the depth of a great and authentic spiritual experience and not as some theorizing philosopher mounted on the thin stilts of speculation. Another time, when we are discussing the West, I make the retort, it is easy for you to attain and keep spiritual serenity in this jungle retreat where there is nothing to disturb or distract you. When the goal is reached, when you know the knower, there is no difference between living in a house in London and living in the solitude of a jungle, comes the calm rejoinder. At once, I criticize the Indians for the neglect of material development. To my surprise, the Maharishi frankly admits the accusation. It is true, we are a backward race, but we are a people with few wants. Our society needs improving, but we are contented with much fewer things than your people. So, to be backward is not to mean that we are less happy. How has the Maharishi arrived at this strange power and stranger outlook which he possesses? Bit by bit, from his own reluctant lips and from those of his disciples, I piece together a fragmentary pattern of his life story. Sourced from the Maharishi and his message.